Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about four remarkable women from the Civil War who will utterly change your view of how women confronted this brother versus brother conflict. My guest today is specialized in writing about women who have shattered their world's preconceived notions of women's roles. Karen Abbott is a historian and biographer whose previous books have profiled a pair of notorious debutante sisters who ran Chicago's most opulent brothel and the stripper Gypsy Rose Lee. Her latest book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War, profiles the flamboyant Confederate spy Belle Boyd, the one figure you probably know from history, Emma Edmonds, or Edmondson, who became Frank Thompson and then served throughout the war in the 2nd Michigan Infantry in the Army of the Potomac, Rose O'Neill Greenhow, who seduced men of influence in the Lincoln administration from her Lafayette Square home across the street from the White House and then sent those secrets to the Confederacy, and Elizabeth Van Loo, a woman living in Richmond, the Confederate capital, who housed escaped Union prisoners of war in her home and placed a servant spy in the home of Confederate President Jefferson Davis. Karen Abbott writes about these remarkable women in her book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy. She writes for the Smithsonian and Disunion, the New York Times series about the Civil War, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Karen Abbott, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rich.
You know, your books have delved into these unusual lives of women who have operated outside of the normal roles. The Everly sisters, who ran a brothel in Chicago, Gypsy Rose Lee. Now, in this book about the Civil War, four women who definitely operated in roles that were outside of what we think of the norm, but was it really outside of the norm that much?
Well, it was. Once I started getting into this research, I was very interested to see what women were doing during the Civil War. And of course, some did things like darn socks and sew uniforms and take care of wounded soldiers. But there were quite a few who decided to go a little bit further. And I wanted to find four women who lied, cheated, stole, wheedled, drank, shot, and murdered their way through the war. hopefully accomplish that with these four women.
Well, and it's not surprising when you actually think about it, because the Civil War was such an intensely personal battle where you had the forces of abolition versus the forces of tradition in the South. And these institutions sort of occupied these women mind, body, and soul.
Well, exactly. Passion ran high on both sides. This was a matter of life and death for them, and they were willing to risk their lives to spy and try to help their side win. I found out during my research there was pretty much nothing these women wouldn't do in order to deliver information to their respective sides and help win battles and change the course of the war. They were all very intent on doing that.
Now, the four women you profile, perhaps one is better known than the other three. The other three were totally unknown to me. Belle Boyd was a well-known Confederate spy, known for her work in the Shenandoah Valley in the early part of the war. But the other three were totally unknown. How did you come across, say, Emma Edmonds, who actually was known in the war as Frank Thompson? She posed as a man to be in the Union Army.
Well, I was intent on finding two women for the North and two for the South, and spent, 5 years researching this book, so I eventually came across the four that I chose. And Belle Boyd fascinated me, number one, the one you're familiar with, because she was all id. She was she had no filter on anything, and she was sort of fascinating that she was really overt in both her opinions and her sexuality, which was, of course, very rare for that time, and especially for a 17-year-old girl. She was sort of like if Sarah Palin and Miley Cyrus had a 19th century baby, I think it would have been Belle Boyd. And Emma Edmonds, I had done some research about women disguising themselves as men and enlisting in the armies, and about 400 women on both sides did so. And Emma Edmonds was the most interesting to me. She had a bit of a tragic backstory. She fled an abusive father and one night just decided to cut her hair and bind her breasts and change her dress for a suit, and started calling herself Frank Thompson, and enlisted in the Union Army in the spring of 1861. And it was fascinating to me how she and all the other women got away with this.
How did she, there had to be a physical when you're inducted into the Army. How did she avoid detection?
Yeah, that was interesting to me. The rules were that everyone would undergo a thorough physical examination, but surgeons across the country flouted these rules. They were desperate to fill their quotas. They had to get the bodies out there. The war was happening, and they were in a rush. So it didn't matter if somebody was deaf or prone to convulsions. You know, it only mattered if they had fingers to pull a trigger, if they had enough teeth to rip off powder cartridges, and if they had feet to march. I mean, it was basically you're good to go if you just had those qualifications. And in Emma's case, the doctor merely shook her hand and said, "What kind of living has this hand earned?" And she said, "This hand has earned primarily getting an education," never specifying what sort of education. But she was passed right then and there and enlisted as Private Frank Thompson.
And served in the Army of the Potomac for most of the war, for the war.
Yeah, she was on the front lines for some of the bloodiest battles. She served as a nurse and a courier, and went undercover to the rebel lines several times. And some of the most harrowing adventures in the book are in her point of view during those undercover missions.
Now, she started out as what sort of somewhat of an orderly to the surgeons, is that right?
Yeah, she started off saying that she wasn't bloodthirsty. She had never shot her gun at a man. She was an expert marksman. She had grown up on a farm in Canada and knew her way around the gun, but did not go into the war wanting to shoot rebels, as many people did on the north side. She thought that she would make an excellent nurse. She always said that she had the power to soothe the delirious, but that changed pretty quickly when she saw her comrades being killed and when she saw the brutality of war up close. And soon enough, of course, Emma Edmonds is not afraid to turn her gun on the Confederates.
Did she ever write about what her motivation was in enlisting? Was she a devout abolitionist? What exactly?
Well, she was. She was a devout Christian and said that she could not abide the institution of slavery. Once she migrated from Canada to the United States, she started hearing about John Brown, the abolitionist who was hanged, and all of the drumbeat of events leading up to the Civil War. And she decided to enlist to play her part in fighting slavery. And also, she was a bit of an adventurous soul, and she said, "I want to see what part I can play in this great drama." So she definitely had that spirit within her, too.
As far as you know, was she ever found out by any of her colleagues?
There is an interesting wrinkle in her story. Of course, if she was discovered, she could be arrested. She might be charged with prostitution. And the worst fate for Emma of all would have been to be kicked out of the Army, which would have happened. But there's a wrinkle in her story fairly early on when she falls in love unexpectedly with a fellow Union soldier. And it's very interesting to read his diary excerpts. He talks about things like, I had an interesting conversation with my friend Frank Thompson about religion, but there's something quite strange about him. I can't quite put my finger on it, but there's something strange about my friend Frank Thompson. And Emma wrestles with her feelings for him and whether or not to, suffer in silence and not tell him that she's falling in love with him, or to risk everything and share her feelings and see what happens. So that's something that plays out throughout the book.
You said you spent a lot of time researching. Did most of these people have diaries, or was it letters and correspondence? Because the way you've written it, and I think you take pains to say, anything I say that they said, it's written in a letter or it's written down that they said this.
Absolutely. There's no invented dialogue. And I did spend quite a bit of time researching. And I went all over. The women, luckily, did all write diaries. There were plenty of letters that referenced them as well. I spent quite a bit of time at the National Archives, where Rose Greenhalgh's cipher was seized and ended up there, and also little bits of correspondence that she had sent to Confederate generals written in her cipher code. So it was fascinating to try to decode her cipher and see exactly what information she was sending to the Confederates. And the New York Public Library has Elizabeth Van Loo's papers, including many death threats that she received. Elizabeth Van Loo was an abolitionist living in Richmond, and she was spying for the Union and received quite a few death threats, and it was absolutely chilling to hold those in my hands, 150 years later, and imagine how Elizabeth felt receiving them, in 1864.
Now let's talk about the other two. Describe them, if you will. Rose O'Neill Greenhalgh, who you mentioned, she was living in Washington, practically in the shadow of the White House, and yet she was a Confederate spy.
Yeah, Rose was an interesting character. Her whole life had fallen apart in the years leading up to the war. She had lost 5 children within 4 years. She had lost her husband in a freak accident, and she had lost her access to the White House. She had been, through her husband's powerful job in the State Department, she had made many friends with the Democratic politicians and had access to the highest echelons of the Democratic government. She'd even been a confidant to President James Buchanan. And all of that ended when Lincoln was elected and the Republicans came into office. So Rose was desperate to get her power back, to get her old life back. So in the spring of 1861, when a Confederate captain offers her the chance to form a Confederate spy ring in the Union Capitol of Washington, D.C., she jumps at the chance. and immediately begins cultivating sources. And by cultivating, I really mean sleeping with, and including several high-ranking Republican politicians, Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts, who was actually Lincoln's chairman of the Committee on Military Affairs, was one of her reported paramours and a high-ranking source, and I imagine they had quite a bit of interesting pillow talk.
Now, prior to the war, when the Democrats were in power, I would assume she sort of had a salon of sorts, or was she kind of a temptress even in those days, or was it more of she was a socialite and she had access to power, therefore people sort of flocked to her, and she had that power and influence?
Absolutely. Her husband only died shortly before the war, so she didn't become the temptress until after the war began. And when people began calling her Wild Rose.
And she was, she was very scandalous. She was well known for the scandal of the whole thing.
Oh, absolutely. And her neighbors all kept track of the comings and goings of her various lovers and chatted about her behind her back. But Rose, you know, did not care. She would have done anything for to help the Confederates win. But she did wield quite a bit of power and influence in Washington, D.C. Before the war broke out. And, of course, that waned. And she really missed that position and missed that power.
And this is the thing that we forget about the Civil War, that there were no real, truly defined borders of you were a Unionist or you were a secessionist. For Rose, living in Washington, D.C., the Union capital, she had intensely Southern sympathy. She had slaves. Elizabeth Van Loo, who is the fourth woman you profile, living in Richmond, the capital of the Confederacy, she has these intense Northern and Union ties.
Oh, exactly. Rose and Elizabeth were interesting to me because they were direct opposites. You know, whereas Rose was a celebrated beauty, people said that Elizabeth was, quote, never as pretty as her portrait showed. And whereas Rose was brazen and outspoken and very overt about what she was doing and what her loyalties were and her beliefs about the Northern government, Elizabeth was quiet and cautious and very discreetly cunning. And she was in just as dangerous position as Rose was, operating a Union spy ring in the Confederate capital of Richmond. And before the war, you know, neighbors just sort of looked at her with a wary eye and thought she was this eccentric spinster living with her mother in a mansion in Church Hill neighborhood in Richmond. But after the war, her abolitionist views were absolutely a dangerous position for her to hold. And she, as I said, received death threats, and Confederate detectives followed her everywhere. But she persisted in forming a really incredible spy ring in the Confederate capital of Richmond.
Was Rose Greenhow's support for the South openly known in Washington?
Oh, absolutely. Rose actually caused quite a scandal at one dinner party that she held when a Republican politician's wife talked about John Brown, the abolitionist, as a holy saint and a martyr. And Rose said that he was a traitor and deserved a traitor's doom. And that was quite a scandalous exchange, and she was very outspoken about her views and continued to be so throughout the war.
Now, you mentioned the cipher that was in the National Archives. She was sending messages regularly, and this was also somewhat of a surprise to me. The border sounds like it was between the two armies. We know it was just outside of Washington for a good part of the war and the Virginia side, but it was a very porous border.
Exactly, and it was especially porous for women who knew how to manipulate men and sort of knew how to exploit the idea that their gender was the weaker sex and that women wouldn't be capable of this type of behavior. There was a scene early in the book in July of 1861 when Rose summons a 16-year-old courier to her home. This courier's name was Betty Duvall, and Rose wraps up an enciphered dispatch into Betty's hair, coils it into a tight bun, and tells her to just cross the lines and pretend she's a farm girl coming home from the market. And, of course, the Union sentries would just see a pretty girl and wave her on by. And Betty did just that, and she went on to Confederate headquarters and let loose her hair and delivered this message. And that message contained vital information about the First Battle of Bull Run, which the Confederates won in a shocking defeat for the Union.
My guest today is Karen Abbott. She's a historian and biographer. Her latest book is titled Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. Three of them were involved in espionage, the fourth, a woman posing as a man and serving in the Union Army. A fascinating look at these women who worked during the Civil War, very much a part of the Civil War, despite having no vote, no access to the political discourse. They're absolutely involved in this life and death struggle for the Union. I guess you found more than these four. I mean, there were a lot of women who were actively involved in this war some way or another.
Oh, there were, and I had to leave quite a few on the cutting room floor whose stories I found interesting, but they just couldn't, you know, fit in the main narrative. I specifically chose these four because their stories wove a tapestry. They touched each other in significant ways. They were always running into the same people, or one woman's actions affected another woman's circumstances. There was a cause and effect there. For example, Rose Greenhow was spying on the Union Army that Emma Edmonds was marching in. You know, she was literally watching Emma Edmonds as Private Frank Thompson marching on Capitol Hill, and Rose's spying, of course, affected the Union Army's fate and Emma's fate. So I really appreciated the way that these stories fit together. But there were many other women who deserved an honorable mention.
Let's talk a little bit about Belle Boyd. As you mentioned, she was complete id, as you described her. And it's amazing to me, this sort of comes up to one of the central themes, that even when women were suspected of being involved in espionage or being a spy, men treated them differently. Belle Boyd, in the very opening days of the war, she's living, I believe, in what would be now West Virginia, Martinsburg. Union troops come into her home, grab her mother. She takes out a pistol and shoots the guy in the head, kills him dead.
Yeah. And she kicks things off with a bang, definitely.
Yeah, and to think, you know, the commanding officer asked what's going on. She said he was attacking my mother and, you know, laying hands on her. And, okay, all right, out the door they go.
You know, it was interesting to me how the women got away with things. Belle did claim self-defense, and part of that, I suppose, was true, but part of it was that the Union Army was reluctant to turn her into a Confederate martyr. They were still trying to quell the rebellion quickly. They thought they could have this war finished in 90 days, and they did not want to blow things up unnecessarily. So they looked the other way in certain cases. But once it became clear that these women were up to more than just mischief, that there was some serious espionage activity going on that was affecting battles, they didn't quite know what to do. One Lincoln official had this great quote about Rose O'Neill Greenhow when it was discovered that she helped the Confederates win the Battle of Bull Run, and he said, quote, "What are we going to do with these fashionable women spies?" And it was a conundrum. You know, it was that suddenly they all realized that women were not always the victims of war. Sometimes they were perpetrators of war. And women were not only capable of treasonous activity, but of executing it more deftly than men. And they did not know how to handle this.
Of course, Belle Boyd's probably most famous exploit was during the Battle of Front Royal, where she literally rides out of the Union camp, rides over to the runs over to the Confederate side and basically tells Stonewall Jackson, hey, strike while the iron's hot. There's not many guys there.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite scenes. And the whole dynamic between Belle Boyd and Stonewall Jackson was really interesting to me. You know, Stonewall Jackson was sort of the Civil War rock star. Women threw themselves at him and swarmed around him. And Belle Boyd, of course, was obsessed with him, even more so than all the other men she was obsessed with. She even told a Northern reporter that she wanted to, quote, occupy his tent and share his dangers, which I think if I were Stonewall Jackson would have frightened me more than anything the Union Army would have done, Belle Boyd obsessed with me.
Yeah, although Stonewall Jackson was pretty crazy in his own right. I mean, he was this fearless man of action, and yet he would pray constantly. He was almost like a borderline mystic in some ways, this sort of mix of bloodthirsty soldier and religious man at the same time. So, I mean, he was his own bottle of contradictions.
Oh, absolutely. He was a very bizarre character and had this weird dichotomy where he, as you said, he prayed, he was very religious, but also he would shoot a man at the drop of a hat, as one of his soldiers said, and he would drop a hat himself. So no reservations about murder either.
And Belle Boyd seemed to be very brazen about what she was doing. I mean, she was obviously hitting Union soldiers up for information, and just as quickly, with very little fear, going over to the Confederate side and telling what she learned.
Oh, absolutely. And it was part of her sort of ingenious disguise. She would say, you know, I'm a Confederate spy. I'm fighting for the Confederacy. But really, how dangerous could I possibly be if I'm standing here telling you that I'm a Confederate spy? So it was sort of her brazenness was part of her disguise and part of her costume, and she sort of, you know, disarmed people with that, and they did not know quite what to make of her.
Elizabeth Van Loo is also a very interesting story. She was living in Richmond, as mentioned, and as the war opens, there are now all of a sudden prisoners. You know, both sides treated the prisoners of war horribly, but certainly the Confederates with far less resources treated them far worse, and literally felt like these were invaders of our land. They don't deserve any sort of rights. And she goes in and says, you know, I want to help these men. And this had to have been very shocking for Confederate Richmond.
Oh, it was. And they didn't know what to make of her either. They would say Elizabeth would go to the Libby prison, which was the largest prison in Richmond at the time, holding all of the Union soldiers, and say, I want to help these men. And they said, well, why don't you help our men first, help the Confederates first? And she quotes the Bible and says, well, God says we should always tend to our enemies before our friends. And so, you know, and then they didn't know what to say to that. And, of course, Elizabeth is just really interested in helping the Union men and not the Confederate men at all. And so sort of used their own, you know, used religion on her side, used genteel Southern manners on her side. She presented herself as this fine, upstanding Richmond woman, a Christian lady who only wanted to do good and do right by the enemy because that's what God decreed. So she definitely used that whole scenario to her advantage.
As the war went on, did the power structures that were aware of these espionage rings in both of their capitals change? Did they change their attitude towards these women who were obviously passing intelligence to either side?
Well, they started becoming suspicious of them. And, you know, the Union government actually sticks the famous detective Alan Pinkerton. They send him to track down Rose Greenhow in Washington, D.C., and there's a great scene where Alan Pinkerton and two of his detectives conduct a stakeout on Rose's home in Lafayette Square, which he always said was within rifle range of the White House. she also called Lincoln Satan, so you can imagine her viewpoints there. But they spy on Rose, you know, peek into her window one night. It's a torrential downpour. And what do they see but Rose discussing military strategy with maps spread out all over the place with a traitorous Union captain. And she becomes public enemy number one, and they become very intent on capturing her. And I love the cat and mouse game she plays with Union detectives in that part of the story.
What about the Confederate agents on Elizabeth Van Loo?
Well, they all suspected her of something that was going on, and every time Confederate detectives would search her home for evidence of treason, she would turn, you know, she would welcome them in as if they were long friends and invite them in for something to eat and say, please search, please, you know, look around, see what you can find, and just, you know, silently pray that they would not find anything, that they wouldn't find the secret room where she was actually stashing escaped prisoners. She held quite a few Union prisoners in her secret room. And then after that, she would start to turn the tables on her accusers and say, how dare you accuse me of such treasonous activity? It is beneath the conduct of an officer and a gentleman and, you know, an insult to an unprotected lady. I'm a defenseless woman, and how dare you accuse me? And, of course, Elizabeth was the furthest thing from a defenseless woman, but that sort of made them back down.
And all these women, to a degree, used their sex as this sort of disguise, didn't they?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, it was a physical disguise. As I mentioned, Rose Greenhow would tie up notes in her courier's hair and send them along the way with things tucked into their hairstyles. And also, quite a few women used their crinoline, that rigid cage-like structure that reached a diameter of 6 feet that they wore underneath their skirts. These crinolines could hold, you know, 80 pounds of materials, goods, sabers, pistols, quinine. Even coffee. They would tie all of manner of goods to their crinoline and just sort of slip across the lines. And nobody had any idea that this was happening. Mothers even used their young children in their espionage games. Rose Greenhow especially used little Rose. And, of course, nobody would suspect an 8-year-old girl of hiding secret dispatches anywhere on her body or in her dolls while she went across the line. So women definitely use their gender as a disguise, and I thought that was one of the most interesting parts of my research.
Was there a Victorian reluctance to actually search a woman?
Oh, there was. There were, well, in some cases, they had to. Rose Greenhow eventually gets searched, I would say fully, and they had female detectives to do that. Alan Pinkerton actually had hired quite a few female detectives, and some of them were put in charge of Rose. But for the most part, if a woman was just going across the lines, and if she didn't wasn't suspected on a high level like Rose Greenhow, they wouldn't search her. You know, a woman could always be indignant if somebody insisted on searching her, and that would probably, in most cases, make the guard back down.
My guest today is Karen Abbott, a historian and biographer. Her latest book is titled Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Story of Four Women Undercover in the Civil War, Belle Boyd, Emma Edmonds, who served in the Union Army as Frank Thompson, Confederate spy living in Lafayette Square, right across from the White House, Rose O'Neill Greenhow, and Elizabeth Van Loo, a Union spy who helped housing escaped Union prisoners in Richmond, and actually had a servant working in the Confederate White House at one point.
Yes, that was one of Elizabeth's biggest coups, and I think one of the most exciting parts of her story. Elizabeth, as I said earlier, was an abolitionist, and she had one favorite slave that she freed when she was a young girl. She freed all of her family slaves, but took a liking to one in particular. And this woman was Mary Jane Bowser. And Elizabeth had sent her up north to be educated and brought her back to Richmond, both of which were illegal in the South at the time. And early in the war, actually December of 1861, she pays a social call to Verena Davis, who was the first lady of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis's wife. And Elizabeth says to her, you know, I hear that you need help in your home. I hear that you're staffing the White House and are looking for good helpers. I have a servant girl for you. She's sort of slow. She's sort of fumbling in the kitchen, but she should serve your purposes. And Verena Davis accepts Mary Jane Bowser into her home. And little does anybody know that Mary Jane Bowser is not only literate, but highly educated and gifted with a photographic memory. So while she's dusting Jefferson Davis's desk and, you know, picking up the children's toys in the nursery, she's also sneaking glimpses at his confidential letters and his maps and all of the drawings of fortifications, and overhearing his confidential conversations and reporting all of this back to Elizabeth. So it was a really risky venture for both of them to be involved in.
At the end of the war, with President Lincoln's assassination, there was the very controversial story of giving the death sentence to Mary Surratt, who was the woman who had the boarding house where all the conspirators met. And there's always been a continuing controversy over whether Mary Surratt was an active part of the conspiracy or was just the boarding house owner who was duped. This gave me second thoughts about what her role might have actually been in the conspiracy to kidnap and then later assassinate Lincoln, because these women were very much women of action. During the Civil War, and it breaks all the stereotypes of what we think how women reacted in the war. I wonder if you've thought about that at all.
I did, and that was one of the most surprising parts of you know, how women's roles changed. It was the first time that women were assertive about war, and that they were the perpetrators of war. You know, of course, there was spying by women done in the Revolutionary War times, but they weren't very open about it. They were very discreet. They were afraid of speaking out, and they did not, you know, write books about their experiences. They did not speak openly against the government, in that case, it would be speaking against the British. But they were very discreet and did not speak about their experiences. And in contrast, in the Civil War, you know, Rose O'Neill Greenhow goes on trial for her espionage activities, and at one point, the men dismiss her even then. And say, well, we think you weren't intent on anything more than mischief. And Rose thinks to herself, mischief? I mean, really? That's you know, she was sort of offended by the downgrade of her contributions. Mischief? And so it really was, to me, the first time that American women actively and openly inserted themselves during wartime.
Well, it's a really interesting book, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy. Karen Abbott, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me, Rich.
Karen Abbott is a historian and biographer. Her latest book is titled Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, Four Women Undercover in the Civil War. It's published by Harper. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own, do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.